All right. Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the Renegade HBG podcast. I am very excited today to be joined by Robert Charette, one of the founding fathers of the BattleTech universe. Robert's novels, Wolves on the Border and Heir to the Dragon, helped lay the foundation for the BattleTech universe, and the miniatures he sculpted helped bring that universe to life on the tabletop. We'll be talking about those early years of the game today and the work and collaborations that gave birth to this universe we all know and love. Bob, thanks for joining me.
Sure. Glad to be here.
So kind of in those early years, where exactly was BattleTech in the development process when you kind of connected with, with FASA and the guys that were in developing?
Well, actually, it's two different questions.
Okay.
I had connected with FASA before there was a BattleTech. Back when FASA's business was doing supplements for the Traveler role-playing game.
Okay.
Had a talk with Jordan Weissman back then, and he suggested that FASA could do supplements for my Bushido role-playing game. They never came about, but that's how we first got into conversation. Mm-hmm. And that, of course, later played into BattleTech stuff.
Yeah.
But I first encountered BattleTech when they premiered it at a GameCon.
Okay.
I can't remember if it was an Origins or a Gen Con. I think it was probably an Origins. And it piqued my interest. And there obviously were no miniatures at that point.
Right.
There were just the two plastic models that came in the box set.
It was a Shadowhawk and maybe a Griffin. You know, were those two?
In BattleTech terms, yeah. They were both Dugong robots. I thought robots were pretty cool.
Yeah.
Particularly giant walking tanks, right? Mm. And I had already had some model kits from Macross because, Warhammer, I can see it behind your head, right?
Yep.
That's one of the most awesome designs ever. It's just perfect.
Yeah.
Not a surprise they chose it for the cover girl for the the game.
Yeah. Yeah, it is a sexy one, but I don't know if you'd seen one of the artists had done a modern rendition of it, which was a great little update. He goes by Spooky on DeviantArt, and Florian Mellies is the artist's name. But if you haven't seen it, I'll email you the kind of copy of the picture. But it looks gorgeous. But yeah, it's definitely stood the test of time. that old Warhammer.
I think one of the things that drove FASA to basically borrow, shall we say, all those designs, was the fact that for the Japanese anime, those guys went through a serious industrial design process. I had picked up a few Japanese modeling / hobby magazines back in the day, completely in Japanese, but, the pictures were in English.
Yeah. the universal language.
Yeah. And they would have lots of images, different angles of these things that were probably used as model sheets for the animation. But before that, they did iterations of the design till they got it looking really cool. That kind of thing makes overall for better design than handing someone a brief and say, okay, I need 50 mechs by next week.
You get some awkward ones out of that. There's some that haven't stood the test of time, but fortunately the early ones held up pretty well. It was kind of later on where they got a little bit funky. But
I might have a disagreement with
you. Okay. So what, other than the Warhammer, certainly you sculpted a lot. Did you get to pick the ones that you sculpted, or were they kind of handed to you? Did you kind of get to cherry pick your favorites and say, I'll do this one?
Well, it's kind of a long story. Obviously you introduced Michael, who's doing the Charette collection stuff. Mm-hmm. And, he's posted up a bunch of stuff I've talked to him about as some of his posts and some of the early experience with that. You had asked how I got involved in BattleTech. And you know, I came away from that original convention really interested in it. And, one of the other guys at Ral Pother also thought it had, you know, some possibilities and stuff. And that was Chuck Crane. He was one of the owners. And pretty much the two of us were the only ones at Ral Pother who were interested in this thing. Yeah. the other owners were convinced to make a pitch for doing the Battle Max. And since I was the only sculptor interested in it, I was tasked to do the proof of concept. Okay. Because Ral Pother had a reputation for organic sculptures, right? And they didn't do a lot of machines.
Okay.
So there was some trepidation on Foss's part that Ral Pother had sculptors who could do machines. Mm-hmm. Of course, the fact that the designs are partly organic helps. Yeah. So I did the first miniature, which was based on a Robotech Valkyrie. And it was sent up to Fossa and they approved it. They decided that Pother could do it. So then we got the assignment. And, but the owners at Ral Pother also were a little concerned about the connection with the Japanese imagery.
Yeah, understandably.
Right. And this was about the same time that Fossa was getting their, you can't use the name Battle Droids because it's got droids in it.
Okay.
And we own that, said Lucasfilm. Mm-hmm. It's like, okay.
which is a questionable thing, but yeah, I can see
it. It is questionable. They certainly didn't have it trademarked at that point. Mm-hmm. But you know, a company like Fossa didn't have the pockets to argue with Lucasfilm after Star Wars success.
Right. And this would have been what, in 84? 83?
No, earlier, certainly. I'm not going to be very good at giving you exact.
Fair. Okay? That was a long time ago.
It was a long time ago. Almost 40 years. Something like that. You know, like, you might not even have been around.
My 40th is next week. So, and I came out in 1980. So,
So the whole battle droids thing came up. Mm-hmm. And so I got a very, you know, okay, we need to do all the mechs, but we don't want them to look like the Japanese ones. So we don't step on that toe. So we're going to do battle droids. Mm-hmm. And we need them right away.
Of course. You need everything right away in business, right?
So, you know, don't make them look exactly like the other ones, but you know, make sure they got all the guns in the right places. And you know, that's how most of the battle droids came about.
Gotcha. And that was the original, the battle droids line of miniatures. And then when was the transition then to the battle mechs?
Well, I did all of those original ones. Mm-hmm. And then there were a couple more added to it during the transition period.
Okay.
Julie Guthrie had done a much closer to the anime look Archer, and a not quite a locus, you know, a little crossbreed with an AT-ST, yeah. The Flea. Mm-hmm. And they had originally been done to be battle droids as the company decided they wanted the line to expand. Mm-hmm. After, you know, sufficient success with the battle droids. I'm a little hazy about, you know, just how things played out. And this was, that stuff all happened before or just as the first technical readout was coming out.
Okay.
Right. And we never got the technical readouts before they came out at Ral Pother, right? You know, okay. We had the miniature line. Well, we got to see the new mechs as soon as everybody else did.
That would make your job too easy. You know, I had a conversation with Blaine, and he was talking just about the novels, how he doesn't even see the novels before he can buy them in the store.
Yeah. So. Well, you know, the the tech readout would come out at a convention, mm-hmm. and the guys at FOSSA would say, "So when are we getting the mechs?"
Yeah. Oh boy.
You know, when are we gonna have the metal? And it's like, we just got the dang things. obviously, the first priority was to do the ones that were in the original game.
Yeah.
And by then, the word had come down. Well, the first ones we did, the word was, do them exactly like the model kits. Which we did, including size.
Oh, okay.
Because that was the brief. They said, copy
yeah,
the model kit.
They said exactly, right? Yeah.
Okay. And that resulted in things like the giant griffin and giant shadowhawk. Mm-hmm. And the oversized stinger and wasp. Oversized now, as we know. So they were available for a certain period of time. And I think the Shadowhawk and the Griffin were the first ones to be replaced.
Okay.
I know I ran a couple of those in games as Super Shadowhawk and Super Griffin at 100 tons.
Yeah. Could be a clan design or something, or a redesign. But
That was done. The clans did not exist at this
point. Yeah, that's way later. What got you into sculpting? I remember reading that you did go to Brown University. Did I read that correctly?
Yes.
And so kind of where did, between that education, which I don't think was in art and sculpting, kind of what got you into that? And what kind of helped you develop those skills that you started to leverage here?
My degree is in geology biology.
Okay.
Because Brown didn't have a paleontology degree.
Okay.
There in those days, this is pre-Jurassic Park.
Yeah.
There wasn't a lot of work for people who wanted a job in dinosaurs.
Okay.
but I had always been a drawer. I would, draw all kinds of things. And I spent, out of college, I got a job doing graphic arts work. This was back before you could do it all on your computer. it was rubber cement and X-Acto blades. And it was work. It wasn't terribly creative, but it was work. And this was also the time I was working on the various role-playing games that I designed with my collaborator, Paul Hume. And I was doing art for those and doing art for a couple of small game companies and such. One of the early gaming pieces I did actually was for a contest that TSR was running in Dragon Magazine. Okay. They were, draw the monster. And they provided a short clip from Fritz Lieber's Fafhrd and the Grey Mouser stories, which was the thing that became the D&D hook horror.
Okay.
And I won that contest with the piece I did. So.
Excellent. And then that was drawing. And how did when you were sculpting, kind of what was that, just kind of self-taught, trial and error? Did you have any kind of someone to mentor you?
I'm pretty much self-taught.
Okay.
This stuff is all tied together.
Of course.
I mean, I got into D&D in the original edition. Back in the days when you had to call a hobby shop to find out if they'd gotten any polyhedral dice in that week. so you could rush down there and get them before somebody bought them.
Well, there is no lack of dice in the gaming world these days.
No, it's, not anymore. and also, those dice were so soft, they would eventually, all the corners would round off.
Oh, boy.
And so they just keep rolling.
Yeah.
Which was not popular either.
No. Not at all.
But I was playing role-playing games, and we were having trouble keeping track of where the characters were when fights occurred. So, we started using miniatures to do that. And eventually I decided I would try to do some.
Mm-hmm.
And showed them to the guy who ran the shop that I visited. And you know, insisted they were the, at least the peer of, you know, what he was selling. Mm-hmm. And so I eventually got connected to a series of small companies sculpting various miniatures.
And what were the materials that you were sculpting out of?
Originally, I was sculpting in Sculpey.
Okay.
Which is a thermosetting plastic material. Mm-hmm. I bake it in a toaster oven. Okay. So it was hard enough.
Yeah.
Now that's really a terrible material for the process that was being used for most of these things, mm-hmm. which involves vulcanized rubber. And vulcanization is a high temperature, high pressure process, and it would destroy this material. So the, you know, the first companies I worked with, they would have to use a room temperature vulcanizing material to make a mold and then cast metal into that to make a master and then do the vulcanizing.
Okay.
So it's, you know, an extra step for right. companies that had very small margins. Mm-hmm. And eventually I was doing that while I was working for Fantasy Games Unlimited, and I'd done some pieces for them in the Sculpey. And at some convention or other, I don't remember which one it was, I took a few pieces over to show to Tom Meyer at Ralph Partha, and he actually wouldn't believe I had done them in Sculpey. They didn't think you could do that kind of detail at yeah. the size I was doing it, because these were 15 millimeter science fiction figures.
Yep.
So that's when I got told about Green Stuff, as it was called.
Yeah.
And very challenging medium to learn.
Yeah. The Green Stuff or the Super Sculpey?
The Green Stuff. The Sculpey had its own challenges. Mm-hmm. The Green Stuff was a two-part epoxy
right.
that you'd mix together, and that's when it would turn green, because it was mm-hmm. you know, yellow and blue.
Yep.
And it would slowly harden. So its characteristics would change during the entire period you were working on it. It's often been described as trying to sculpt in bubble gum.
Okay. I've only used it to connect two parts, and so I haven't done much sculpting in it. But yeah. I gotta imagine there's just a time curve of kind of how much softness. Which I guess when the more you do it, the more you can kind of use that to your benefit. You know, but
well. You know, like any craft that involves a lot of eye-hand coordination mm-hmm. and training, when you start it, I could never do that, right? And you can't at mm-hmm. first. But, you know, 20 years later, it's like, okay, you just do it this way, no problem.
Yeah.
And you're doing things that you thought you could never do. Mm-hmm. Perseverance pays off, yeah. you know, if you pay attention to your learning.
Well, it's the 10,000 hour rule, right? You know, 10,000 hours of, playing with green stuff.
The magic number, yeah.
It's a lot of hours playing with green stuff, but, you get there. Do you have a favorite miniature, that you kind of came up with that you're like, you always look at me like, you and I, we've been through a lot, but
you know, people ask me that about the novels, and yeah. you know, that's a very small number
yeah.
compared to the number of miniatures I have made at this point.
Yep.
I mean, yeah, there's definitely some I like better than others, mm-hmm. but I also like them for different reasons, which makes yeah. it very hard to yeah. pick a single one. You know, some of the mechs, and you know, I'll stick with BattleTech here, because that's what yeah. we're talking about. You know. You know, some of them I like a lot because I like the designs, but I have others that, well, I'll name one. The Caesar is a design I didn't much care for,
okay,
but it ended up on my sculpting list.
Yeah.
But in the process of doing it, it came out so well, and I felt that I had achieved an improvement on the rough sketch that's in tech manual to make it work in three dimensions. And no, just everything was working on all cylinders when I was working on that one. Yeah it's kind of a goofy design, but I still like it a lot.
You know, that's amazing that you said that, because the Caesar is one of my favorite of the old mechs, and not a lot, and the miniatures is what drove it. So, you know, it's kind of inspired me as well to kind of appreciate that model. It's it's actually, I started teaching myself to paint earlier this year, and almost all of the stuff I've painted has been the newer plastic stuff, and the Caesar is the only one that I actually took the time to magnetize the metal sculpt, and it's got both arms magnetized and the Gauss rifle on the front, and I've got it primed, and I'm like, I don't want to paint it until my skills get better, because I spent so much time getting that magnetization perfect, especially that little cannon, that I'm like, I don't want to mess it up. I gotta wait till my skills are worthy of this sculpt to do. But but that's funny.
The Caesar is also one that, you know, if you're handy with a razor saw, you could section it, put magnets in at the waist, and then you could torso twist with it.
Yeah. Getting the waist magnets is a tricky one on the metal one for sure. But
some of the designs, the parts hang down over the waist area.
Yeah.
Or you can't get at them.
Yeah.
To modify them that way. But
lift it up. Kind of taking a step back then, you know, about kind of the BattleTech outside of the sculpting and kind of creating that universe. You know, your novels are beloved by the fan base. You know, and I know Wolves on the Border is you know, my personal favorite and the favorite of many others. You know, and so I'm really, really interested in kind of what you know what brought you into writing those novels, and what the process was like between what I imagine based on the publishing dates, that it seemed like kind of almost like a four-way collaborative process between you and William H. Keith and Michael Stackpole and Robert Thurston, you know, because those novels really blend together extremely well. And so I don't know if that was kind of by happenstance from a really good outline that Fawcett gave you, or if you guys were really interactive in that process to create that early universe.
It's complicated.
Okay. Well, let's dive right, in. Let's dive in. I know everyone listening wants to hear.
Right. there's several parts to your question, so I'm going to have to address them in several parts. Oh. Right. I'll start with how I got involved, if that works for you.
Definitely.
Like I said, everything's connected. You know, I had been running role-playing games, game mastering, and was getting progressively more and more frustrated that the players would never manage to actually organize themselves in such a way that we would get to a satisfying conclusion of something, right? You know, they follow along for a while, and then they all, you know, usually wander off right when they're supposed to be having the climactic encounter. And because of the way I was creating the adventures and the increasing amount of character interaction that was happening in our games, you know, it was a little bit like, you know, working out the whole story and as if it were a novel, you know, with characters and character interaction, and then never getting to the conclusion. Very frustrating. So, you know, I conceived the idea that maybe I should just write a book. That would be a better way for me to get out the creative interest that I had in these stories. So I approached Jordan Weissman at a convention. This was early on. I think Thunder Rift was already out. Okay. And said, so you guys are doing novels now, you know. Are you looking for folks to write for you? And he's like, who wants to know? I said, well, I thought I might. And he said, yes. I obviously hadn't written one at that point, right? Mm-hmm. So I had no credentials. But they were looking for someone to write the story of the Dragoons leaving the Draconis Combine.
Okay.
And since it involved the Dragunas Combine, you remember back what I said, Jordan approached me about things for Bushido?
Yeah.
He figured that I, in my, you know, the work I had done in researching Japan for Bushido made me, of the people they knew, uniquely qualified to handle Cretan stuff.
Yeah.
So, you know, I put together a short précis of how I thought the novel would go and sent it to them, and they approved that. And I said, you know, go forth and do it.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, pretty much the only thing they asked about was, it's the story of the Dragoons leaving the Combine.
Okay.
And that's most of the rest was left to me.
Wow.
I had also put together a short sample featuring the Black Widow Company, because, you know, that was out. So there was material to look at to see with the Dragoons. And, you know, so based on the fiction elements that were in there, you know, I wrote it a certain way and turned it in. And I got told, we don't want Natasha to swear in Russian. You know, too cliched.
Yeah. Okay.
And it's like, okay, but she's swearing in Russian in the thing you just put out.
Right.
But that should give you some idea of how fast things were changing in the BattleTech universe.
Yeah.
You know, much like in the original game, you know, the mechs were handed down, you know, most of them weren't being made anymore.
Right.
You know, they were scavenged from the battlefield. And then the first tech readout came out and every single mech was being built somewhere. Mm-hmm. Every single one.
Yeah.
Which is like,
yeah, we explored that when I was talking with Michael and just kind of, you know, talking about those early days where it was kind of that more dystopian kind of, you know, a future and then kind of the imagining the need to actually have a profitable business kind of helping them to realize that probably wasn't the best idea, that there needed to be some kind of forward momentum in the universe to kind of, you know, encourage more products and more sales.
Well, the idea that the tech was getting worse was Jordan's.
Mm-hmm.
And, it was one of his, you know, big twist concept ideas. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, that's kind of twist that plays against the need of a commercial product.
Yeah.
There was the Grey Death Legion stories where they find the knowledge core.
Right.
No. And among the first novels.
Yeah.
And suddenly even more stuff is available.
Yeah. And had you said that the first Decision on Thunder Rift had come out, beforehand. Did where was your writing kind of timed with the release of like Mercenary Star and Price of Glory, where they were, you know, talking about that Helm Memory Core and that release, and were you and was Stackpole writing the Warrior trilogy at the same time you were writing Wolves on the Border, or was there some kind of, you know, stacking or progression there?
I think we were writing them separately at the same time.
Okay.
There was a conference held in Chicago that we both attended, as well as some other folks who, you know, besides the on staff Vossa team, there were some other folks there, and I'm a little fuzzy on who they all were, because, you know, I walked into that conference, you know, not knowing anybody but Jordan and Ross. Full disclosure, I'm an introvert, so, you know, it's always a challenge for me to walk into a room full of strangers. And, you know, sitting there taking that all in, and about the same time, they decided they had another assignment for me, and they wanted me to do the Ted Kurita story, as Jordan phrased it. I say, okay, well, you know, I'm going to need to know what's going on. You know, has anybody used Theodore? And Mike put his hand up. I said, yeah, I used him in a scene. Okay, what sort of scene? Oh, yeah, well, you know, he's in this staff meeting, and he pulls out a gun and shoots a general.
Okay.
And I'm like, oh.
Yeah, that's somewhat okay. Character defining there. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I have to write about a homicidal maniac. That was not in my mind. And in the course of the weekend, Mike also later remembered he used him in another scene where, not to put too fine a point on it, Theodore pulled out a gun and shot somebody as a way to end the conversation, right?
Yeah.
And it's like, definitely a homicidal maniac. Mm-hmm. This is not the kind of character I want to write. So I was able to read those two scenes before I finished my book. And I actually rewrote both of those scenes from Theodore's point of view.
Mm-hmm.
All the dialogue is identical.
Yeah.
But it's a very different spin
yeah.
on what Mike had
right.
positioned it as.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and, you know, part of it was my desire to have a more likable central mm-hmm. character for the story.
Yeah.
Someone who wasn't a homicidal maniac. And part of it also was, I was watching what was happening in some of the other books in the Caretan appearances.
Mm-hmm.
And they were more and more portrayed as basically a Yarlow Peril menace that was, you know, no redeeming qualities.
Right.
And that is a terrible representation of the Japanese character.
Mm-hmm.
It's a terrible representation to put in a game. And it just doesn't make a good story.
Right. Well, I think, you know, those most familiar with Baltic, everyone tries to assign the houses to a nationality and tries to frame the good guys and bad guys. And, you know, certainly in the fan groups on Facebook or whatnot, people are very quick to point out that there are no good guys, right? They all have their redeeming qualities and their deep faults, you know? And so that's awesome kind of hearing you talk about that and recognizing the danger that the universe had kind of heading toward that trope. You know, and kind of pulling him back from the edge and being like, no, there's no good, bad guy, or there's no good guy, there's no bad guy. You know, these are big, big, you know, not even nations. I mean, you're talking about star empires. And so right. the amount of nuance and the amount of different kind of personalities within there is vast. That's contributed a lot to the universe is having that character.
The early stuff was heading that way.
Yeah.
You know, small as it was in terms of book count, you mm-hmm. know, part of my mission was to put somewhat of a break on that.
Yeah. Well, it's just from hearing you, you know, this sounds remarkable because it's seeming that you guys had very little interaction along the way, and kind of as I noted before, of kind of how. Well, these novels fit together, you know, between, and granted William Keith's novels, you know, are kind of separate, you know, they have kind of their own events happening, but the events that are happening in Wolves, and Air and the Warrior Trilogy, and then mm-hmm. later, you know, with Lethal Hell, sorry, the Blood of Kerensky Trilogy, plus your Wolf Pack, you know, there's a lot of cohesion between those novels. And it's surprising for me to hear you say that you guys were kind of just given this very bare bones outline and kind of were able to go and kind of come out with this product. So was there some kind of, you know, editing at the end where people came back and kind of had to make sure they fit together well in a puzzle, or did it just happen to fall very well, you know, together because you guys were, I guess, ultimately drawing from the same source books?
Well, one thing you got to keep in mind that this was pretty much the early days of the multimedia approach to games.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Dungeons and Dragons had done some novels successfully. And, you know, Fawcett was just dipping its toes in the water here. You know, they published Decision at Thunder Rift with no idea whether it would be successful or not.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and Bill Keith tried to explain some of the weirdnesses of the game. You know, things like the autocannons carrying 12 rounds.
Right.
You know, so he made up the whole cassette ammunition thing. Okay. 12 cassettes of multiple rounds.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not everybody followed that right away.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you can read a lot of Battletech novels and it's like, okay, they transcribe their games.
Yeah.
And that was never something I liked.
Mm-hmm.
And I can recall Michael mentioning when he was talking to you about how I ripped him a new one about that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Where I was not targeting that at him, actually. He was doing a halfway decent job of not doing that. But some of the battles did get a little, yeah, I'm watching a game.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's good fiction.
No. Yeah.
And that's what I was trying to communicate to him, because I'd seen people do far worse than him at that. You know, it was an evolving process. Mm-hmm. Okay. You know, the brief had, you know, the technology other than the fusion reactors and the energy weapons, right? Basically World War II level technology.
Okay.
So, you know, I had, okay, that's the brief. Okay, we'll run with that. You know, no satellites, which is why it was a big deal when I gave Wolf Stragoon the satellite as part of the explanation of why they could do things other people couldn't do. I wrote a scene with an aerospace pilot pulling high G's and basically wrote him wearing the equivalent of a late World War II pressure suit, which used water to keep the blood flowing by pumping it around the thing. And I just, oh, no, that's too high tech.
Okay.
You know, but I did my research. You know, and it's World War II tech.
Yeah.
It's like, no, can't have that. Okay.
Yeah. You can jump from star system to star system, but you can't pump water in your flight
your jumpsuit.
Suit.
Yeah. No. but there were some things like that. One of the interesting things of working with people is people bring a lot of different things to it. Right. And Fossa had an in-house editor at that time who really wasn't into this military stuff, had very much other interests. And she was very good, I think, for a lot of the game writers, but didn't always listen to her writers. I mean, she caught me making some mistakes. Very clean.
Yeah.
But we had a go around, for example, about Samovars. She was insisting that Samovars are only used for coffee.
Okay.
And I had written a scene where the Samovar was used to make tea. Right? Because Karit, funny thing you mentioned about the nationalities.
Mm-hmm.
I had a conversation with Sam Lewis early on. And yes, indeed. There were basically two nationalities that were smooshed together for each of the houses. And Karita was Japan and Russia. So I put a samovar in to make the tea. You know, the Japanese don't use them, but the Russians do.
Yeah.
And, you know, I did my research to find out about Russian samovars.
Mm-hmm.
And the editor insisted I was wrong. Yeah, so you win some, you lose some.
Yeah, definitely. Well, you know, talking specifically more about kind of Wolves on the Border. And so Wolves on the Border is your first novel, not just your first BattleTech novel, your first novel.
Yes.
So, you know, and, you know, obviously you'd put a lot of time and passion into Bushido, you know, and that this is, you know, seems like it was kind of an outlet for you to kind of finally express that, you know, in a cohesive story. And so what, I'm always kind of curious, you know, for writers, if they kind of write the character and they let the kind of the story kind of evolve with it, or if you had a framework for kind of what was happening in the story and kind of thematic elements that you wanted to bring to and then fill in kind of the story around it, kind of which kind of approach, if either of those, you know, did you prefer, and kind of how did that come to create Wolves on the Border, you know, as the novel?
Well, obviously different writers work different ways. Mm-hmm. That's always going to be a truism. You know, for Wolves on the Border, I mean, obviously my memories of Wolves on the Border, because it was the first one, in some ways are a lot stronger than later works.
Yeah.
And, you know, I had previously done a lot of work into Japanese culture, and clearly the book was focused more heavily on that than the Russian culture. And, you know, I had the House Corita source book to look at, you know, flipping through it, looking for inspiration, you know, trying to find things that could play into this, you know, finding out who was in charge of where the Dragoons were and, you know, where they were supposed to be stationed. Those things were all set out. Mm-hmm. Some hints of the characters of some of the personalities were in the early gaming materials, you know, the Black Widow's source book, adventure book, you know, introduced her company, you know, right. They all had short write-ups at the very least, you know, they expressed a certain kind of character in the little fiction bits, you know, we got bits of that about J.B. Wolfe, who I'm pretty sure when originally named may have supposed to have been Jaime Wolfe, given the way it's spelled.
Yeah. Interesting.
But everyone always called him Jamie.
Okay.
So I went with that.
Yeah.
Flipping through the book, there was this one illustration, I think Jim Holloway did it, of a black samurai painting pottery. And I said, I want to write about that guy. Right? Because here's a black guy that has embraced the culture he's living in. Right? He's not black, he's Caridan. He just happens to have black skin.
Right.
And, you know, again, that was part of the, let's not do all stereotypes here.
Well, that's interesting, because it hadn't even occurred to me, but I can't recall any hint of racism in BattleTech. It is all about house and loyalty. There, I don't remember any, but maybe I'm remembering wrong.
The Capella Confederation.
Okay.
Oh, good God.
Yeah.
They were even worse yellow peril than the Caridans.
Fair.
You know, they were cast as the bad guys, and they were. You know,
well, I guess within the universe, you know,
within the universe,
yeah, 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 okay.
You know, in all those first stories, and the first one of the things that happens in franchises, particularly gaming franchises, the material that comes out first sets expectations, right? People didn't understand it back then, but I've watched it develop in BattleTech. I mean, Davion became the heroes, right? They had one of the first source books. And they were against Corita in one of the first source books, right?
Yeah.
So it was that feud, and that was the go-to place, right? And then they cooked up the, well, we're going to have Steiner aligned with Davion. So that became the good guy axis.
Right.
Right? And the evil axis of nastiness, you know, who are the bad guys and do terrible things all the time, as opposed to our good upstanding heroes who also all happen to be white.
Yeah, well, certainly as the universe evolved, you know, they weren't all good doing good things all the time.
No, but that was a pullback from mm-hmm. that.
Yeah,
they began to recognize it was going that way. Right, but the last, you know, like I said, I talked with Sam about you know what some of these inspirations were, and you know, you go back. And you look at the house books and you look at the various forces they have. What are the two house books that have assassins? Caridin and Capellans.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately the assassins started coming later with Davion between poor old Melissa. I see what you're saying now. You know, I was kind of thinking more in terms of the kind of, the black, white, you know, kind of in universe. I've never heard the novels kind of, you know, call out that, but I definitely see kind of the nationality kind of the reflection of the political environment at the time. Interesting that, you know, is kind of using the Japanese instead of the Russian element of it, since the Russian was definitely kind of the real world kind of opposition at that time. But I didn't want to pull too far off that wolf pack, because I definitely enjoy kind of hearing this origin story of Wolves on the Border and kind of, you know, how you're kind of coming through that. And so you've got this idea of Minobo through Jim Holloway's illustration and kind of and just kind of, you know, how that evolved into the story. And it just, for me, you know, the complexity of the politics, you know, and, you know, kind of the, or I'll take a step back. And one of the things that I enjoyed the most, and Tex Talks does some wonderful BattleTech videos. I don't know if you've caught them, but they talk about the history, and it's, he had done one where he was talking about, you know, why the inner sphere had kind of stepped back into that feudal environment, you know, as related to basically the ability to travel and communicate, you know. And for me, that really clicked, and I hadn't kind of put that together through my own understanding of history and readings of history to that point of why that was appropriate for the time, and why kind of back, you know, in the Middle Ages that a democracy in the modern sense wouldn't have worked, because there's not enough instant communication. You know, you're talking about weeks, months, maybe a year to get from one side of a kingdom to another, or an empire to another, and that in the inner sphere it essentially kind of went back to that because of its expansive nature. And you know, the fact that within the Curita and the Wolves on the Border, you know, have you know, you have your kind of renegade, you know, general that's acting, and you have, you know, Takashi Kurita that can't just expunge his generals for doing things that aren't what he wants, but he's definitely not happy, you know, with those decisions that are being made. And that was just a very fun dynamic for me. And I really enjoyed it, you know, more kind of coming back and reading as an adult, because the first time I read this, I was 14, 15. And so the themes that I pulled out of that were honor and duty and loyalty, you know, themes that kind of, you know, I embraced kind of at that point in my life. And now kind of reading back, of looking at just the complexity of leadership, you know, and management, you know, also kind of ring back to me. And so I really enjoy that, you know, about the novel. And I enjoyed how you dealt with kind of, you know, the challenges and the conflicts that arise, because, you know, people are people, and they're kind of, you know, they do what's in their own best interest. But yeah, and how you kind of evolved the story from that.
Well, you know, a significant part of that is a very, very Japanese cultural thing, particularly in the samurai culture. Mm-hmm. The conflict between giri, duty, and gimi, human feelings. Mm-hmm. And that's a classic conflict in Japanese literature and art. You know, the struggle between doing what's right and proper and what, you know, you're required to do by society, and the fact that you're a human being with emotions that are at war with this. And, you know, that's one of the subtle but on plain view, if you know enough of the issues, it's unresolved at the end of the novel.
Yeah. As it is in life, always, you know, well, unresolved, but, on some
you know,
level.
I'm, there are always new readings coming up, you know, so when hesitates to spoil the ending even now.
He's not doing it.
But that was a radical ending for the time, mm-hmm. for an American book. It's how I knew the story had to go, but it's not what I originally pitched to them because I didn't think they'd accept it. But after the book, you know, an early version of the book went in, Jordan said, you know, Minobu really needs to end it the way it does. And I said, okay, because that was the story that, as it should have been.
Yeah.
But even then, the ritual at the end has a lot of significances in it. You know, when we, in America anyway, mostly only see the broad brushes of it. And partially because it titillates us that a culture could be so committed to that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But it's usually, I don't know. I mean, do you want me to spoil it? I mean, I can put names to
things. I can put a spoiler warning on the video. I can say spoiler coming up and people can skip forward and I'll put a bookmark that'll let them do it.
Because it'll make it much easier to talk about this.
Yeah, let's do it. All right, so spoiler warning, everyone. And I'll put a timestamp here for you. Skip to this point in the video. And
Well, it's about seppuku, right? The ritual suicide. And Minobu eventually is put in a position where that's the answer. And, you know, that was the bit that wasn't originally in the first draft, but should have been. And when he commits seppuku, there's a particular part of the ritual about where he wraps the rice paper on the blade. You know, it's normally done right at the hilt, but he wraps it above the hilt. And that's a message that despite the fact that he's doing this to atone and that it should restore his honor, wrapping it where he wrapped it indicates that he does not consider it sufficient.
That's good. The nuances. Yeah.
Right. And mm-hmm. that says something about the whole situation. Mm-hmm.
Like I said, things were really done by bootstraps mm-hmm. in the very early years.
Yeah.
Right. I got a warning that the Dragoons came from elsewhere because, you know, it was a big mystery originally. They deliberately planted a lot of seeds where they didn't have answers.
Okay.
Right.
Well, that was going to be a follow-up question. When in your process did you get that they could be from elsewhere? No.
Remember 40 years ago, you know, some of it's a little vague.
Okay.
But I deliberately started laying hints that they had a culture that was not obvious.
Okay.
Right.
Well, certainly in the, I forget which novel it is, but the scene where they're talking and they decide to break the contract and recall everybody. And the first clan word is spoken. My memory is faded on this and what it is. So, and I don't know if you're knowing what I'm talking about, you can kind of help guide me to my point, but.
Well, I mean, there are a couple of words I used that became clan words,
mm-hmm.
you know, at least one of those, there was no clan when I put it in there and it became a clan word when the clans started to be solidified.
Mm-hmm.
There was a conference in Chicago where, you know, they had, the FASA team had decided that the clans were coming and there was going to be a trilogy bringing that in.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they wanted one about how, you know, well, Shagoons was going to handle that since it turns out that they were from the clans.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of things that I wrote, I had to adapt to some of their new concepts, and, you know, put my own stamp on it.
Yeah.
You can't have writers writing without them trying to put their own stamp on things.
Of course.
Whatnot, you know? And in BattleTech, you know, everybody's got to have a mech, right? You got to have your own mech.
And was that after the publication of Wolves, or somewhere between you writing it and it getting published?
Wolves on the Border was published before the Worklands.
Yeah, yeah. And so that this was around the time of Wolfpack. You know, was that, or was an Heir of the Dragon?
Wolfpack wasn't written until after that conference.
Okay.
You know, because I knew there were going to be clans. I knew some of what they were. Mm-hmm. But again, for the most part, I was waiting. You know, I read Thurston's first book when I got sent a copy of it. You know, there was no advance on it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we were told several things, that this is the plan. This is what we want to do. You know, the first appearance of the clan, you're not even sure they're human.
Right.
Right. The mechs look different. They've got the elementals. I'm not even sure they were called elementals then. They may have just, you know, battle suited infantry.
Yeah. And I know the publication order, but in terms of the order that they were written, did Way of the Clans come before Lethal Heritage in terms of introducing the clans, or was Lethal Heritage the...
I'd have to go... Well, I can't dig them out anymore. Michael sold a lot of my copies. But yeah. I'd have to look at the copyright dates myself.
Gotcha. Okay. Because I know it was happening very close. I mean, it was kind of like bap, 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 you know, in terms of the novels.
Yeah, we didn't communicate so much directly then.
Okay.
We didn't have the kind of writer's retreats the same way mm-hmm. that they have over the years. There were more of these, okay, you are the guys who are working on this project with us. Here's what we're going to do. Mm-hmm. Go forth and make it happen kind of approach. You know, like I mentioned, rewriting from Theodore's point of view, mm-hmm. a couple of scenes. And one of them was where he shoots a certain character, and Mike had written it that, you know, and the scene ends in black, right? You know, mm-hmm. the gunshot goes off, black screen, you know, classic TV kind of thing, right?
Yeah.
Well, he later thanked me for not killing that character.
Oh, for a good reason, yes, for those.
Because he brought him back,
yes.
and made him prominent.
Yes.
In the storyline he was doing.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that wasn't in his original plans, but it right. was something I did. So we were clearly reading each other's books and, you know, working with them and, mm-hmm. and around them, occasionally trying to rewrite them if it wasn't quite what we wanted.
Yeah.
Certainly when I did that, I was always motivated not so much to, you know, well, you know, F you, it really should have been this way,
mm-hmm.
but okay, I want to make it a better story, at least a better story to me.
Yeah. Well, that's an awesome revelation there. You know, the fandom can know who, you know, where that favorite character, you know, owes his sort of origin to, his rebirth, I guess. and consequently the rest of the Inner Sphere owes as a debt of gratitude to that decision from you. Very cool. That's a cool little tidbit there.
Well, I certainly felt that character at that point certainly had earned the right to spend the rest of his life in a closed cell with no one else around.
Yeah. Yeah. That's redemption, right? It's a, you know, everyone's favorite, story arc, you know, from, mm-hmm. from Vader to all others. What, you know, kind of coming back, there's certainly a big break between Wolfpack and the initiation to war in a very different time in the kind of the BattleTech universe. You know, what was kind of different about that process for you of kind of coming back, or what inspired you to come back and write for BattleTech, and how is it different kind of writing now where there's an expansively defined universe that you have to write within versus basically you're creating it as you go?
Well, I think you're asking me about the jump between Wolfpack and Initiation to War.
Yeah.
Obviously, I had been away for a while. at that point. Things had very much progressed. I was not a big fan of what the clans did to the game as a gamer. You know, and much of that arises from being a gamer, okay? You know, I love BattleTech. I love the fact that you could play a company. And in the early days, if you played it enough, you didn't even need the sheets. You knew what all the numbers were. Yep. So you could play the game, not the numbers.
Right.
And then, you know, all the new tech, you know, all the, you know, all the variants and the lasers and stuff. And it was just too much to keep track of. And, you know, you couldn't run a company anymore. At least I couldn't. So for, you know, a brief period, I was still playing it and make a point of not running clan mechs most of the time. Mm-hmm. Take a perverse pride in taking clan mechs down with tanks.
Okay.
you know, I didn't like what it was doing. I thought there was so much more material could have been done with what was set up that never got touched. But the universe went in another direction. I was also being distracted by other things,
right,
because I worked with Fawcett to design Shadowrun. And part of my contract to be lead designer on that included that I got to write the first trilogy.
Yeah.
So, you know, that was an opportunity for me to set a tone to the universe. And, you know, much like I still hearing things like, you know, you wrote the best standalone BattleTech novel kind of thing. I get, you know, oh, you wrote the good Shadowrun books. So,
well, I will. I'll put them on my reading list. I'll pick up the trilogy, even though I haven't played Shadowrun. Yeah. But I'd love to read some more of your work there. What you know, I still want to kind of get back to the difference in how you came back to Initiation to War. But before I forget, you talked about those untold stories, and that plays into a question I had for later. It's like, what is a story that you wanted to tell in BattleTech that you never got a chance to?
Well, I probably would have followed on from, you know, the Dragoons having their own planet.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the Caritan characters that I'd written, you know, I brought them back in various ways.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I think some of them had more stories to tell. Part of the way I work is, you know, it can start in various places. It might be the inspiration of seeing the picture that became Minobu, mm-hmm, from Wolves on the Border in the source book. Or it might be, you know, this would be a neat thing to do, you know, to have happen, to deal with this kind of circumstance. A lot of different ways that things could have gone. I mean, I actually sent one of my characters off who became the bounty hunter back when there was a bounty hunter, right? Mm-hmm. You know, the whole Dread Pirates Robert version of that was mine.
Yeah.
Right. Because you can do things with that.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You know, you can have the man in black come back and save the Princess Bride, but you could do other things with it too. You know, it's Captain Blood, right? Which is not exactly a new novel.
Yeah.
And, you know, most people know it from the movie. But, you know, a guy who goes off and becomes a pirate, right?
Yeah.
Right? But, you know, that's not his real name. But, you know, he does think, you know, the honorable bounty hunter is a thing. Seen a show called The Mandalorian?
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. He's wearing Mandalorian armor. He could be anybody.
Yeah.
Right? So there's an element of it in there, you know. I didn't have a specific story that I wanted to write in between there because I was working on Shadowrun. which kind of occupied everything. And the universe kept changing and getting further and further away. So, you know, that's why I went out to the periphery.
Yeah.
Where I didn't have to worry about the 50 million different political things that were happening in the inner sphere. Some of which was like, oh crap, I don't want to deal with that.
Well, if nobody has planted the seed in your head, you know, let me do it. But, you know, they have the Shrapnel episode, our issues that are coming out, the compilation of short stories that cover all the errors. And so if you have an itch to write for some more, any of those stories, those untold stories, you know, well, people would love to see, you know, the next Shrapnel have a Robert Charette short story based in whatever time period it inspires you and you want to kind of cover.
Well, it's come to my attention that that has happened. Mm-hmm. And, you know, BattleTech having survived this long, that's something that can happen now.
Yeah.
Right. The whole idea that there are places you could write in those niches and fill in the stories is a great thing for the universe, I think.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I want to go there now.
Yeah.
You know?
That's life has moved on. I get that. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah. You know, Michael told you that, you know, BattleTech was a very small part of my life. And it's like, yeah, it may have occupied a small number of years, but
it was impactful.
I kind of have a lot of interests.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can certainly tell by telling you what my degree was. And, you know, I obviously haven't made a career of that. And I've gone off and done other things. But I haven't, my interest hasn't completely gone away. I don't know. You know, I went out with the MechWarrior book to be out in the periphery just to, you know, get closer to the stuff I was familiar with without having to do the backlog. I mean, I have trouble imagining how someone can keep track of all this stuff these days without devoting their life to it. There's just so much material.
Well, I had mentioned that in my last podcast, actually, just how, you know, my gaming is, I game primarily in 3025, and I, you know, I may kind of play in 3050, but I don't put 3050 on the table that much just because that's my capacity. You know, I don't have the capacity to, you know, these people that can game in any era, I have immense respect. There's a lot of fun, a lot of cool things you do, but I'm like, all right, I'm going to focus on this era. You know, there's plenty to focus on, and maybe when I exhaust it, I can move on to the next. But
yeah, now you're just expressing the attitude that I was talking about with regard to what was happening in the universe me. Definitely. Right?
Yep.
It was too much, and there were things undone. But you know, I've written for FASA and its successors what I've been asked. You know, when they did the big anniversary volume, was it
the 25th anniversary? Yeah,
the hardback one. Mm-hmm. You know, they got in touch with me and said, would you like to write a story?
Mm-hmm.
And so I did, and I actually took advantage of there could be any error thing. And I reused one of my characters. I never mentioned his name, but
yeah. The savvy reader will know.
Character is not someone you haven't seen before.
Yeah.
Just pay attention to the physical description and you'll know who it is.
Mm-hmm.
Assuming you've read the stuff I've written.
Yeah.
Which you can never do.
I haven't gone to Initiation War yet, but I did read the short story in 25 years.
I'm sorry. Say again, please.
I said I haven't gone to Initiation War yet in my chronology. I got up to I Am Jade Falcon as a teen, and I've been rereading once I picked it back up, and I'm up to Blood of Heroes now. So I got a ways to go to get to Initiation War, but I did kind of check out.
Yeah, well, if you're reading everything in order, there's a lot to read.
Yes. Yeah, we may skip the Dark Ages so I can skip ahead to the current stuff once I get there. But yeah. And every time something new comes out that isn't isn't at the end of the timeline, I'm excited. Like, you know, Michael had written his Origin of the Killhounds, you know, which is the book I'm reading right now. So it was nice to be able to say, okay, I can read a new book because it's set back here and it's not going to spoil anything.
Yeah.
In that universe. Is there a kind of back to, that's a novel question. Is there any book that you read that, you know, kind of was a favorite for you, you know, that wasn't yours, or a scene in another book that really kind of stood out as kind of a favorite scene, know, either in the earlier or later novels?
Ah, wow. There's so many I haven't read, okay. You know, so.
Well, we'll make it easy. We'll make it easy on it. You can stick to the ones you have read.
Yeah, well, most of those are really old. Mm-hmm. Michael brought by a couple he thought I would be interested in because they involved Wolf's Dragoons. Mm-hmm. So those are actually the most recent ones I've read. You might have got the sense that I'm something of a nitpicker about writing. Not a writer. I'm a fussy writer. Because it's recent to me, what was it called? It was also an author that is relatively recent to the canon.
Okay. Maybe Schweitzer?
Redemption Rift, maybe?
Okay. I think that's to check. I haven't read
it. They gave me one by Blaine and one by the fellow whose name I didn't know at the time and now can't remember. Yeah. Too many names, not enough brain cells.
Yeah.
But it was starring the Dragoons and went back very heavily into history. Mm-hmm. The characters were busy spending a lot of their time thinking about things that had happened 100 years ago instead of things that had happened in their lifetimes, which was an odd sort of thing, but charming in a way. I think that's part of why Michael recommended it to me, because it touched on a lot of the stuff I had written.
Yeah.
But I was particularly struck by how well that author managed to write the battles without it making sound like a game.
Awesome.
Turn by turn.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he had a really wide vocabulary repertoire for the various weapons going off and what they did to machines. And I always found that a struggle to try to not have it always sound the same.
Yeah.
But, you know, he also has the benefit of, you know, decades of people trying to write this stuff and come up with different ways to say it.
Yeah.
So, you know, I certainly enjoyed that part of it. It was long and intricate novel. He brought me these two, and Blaine's was quite short.
Mm-hmm.
And it actually had larger typeface. So the words were bigger.
Yeah.
And a smaller typeface for the other one. So, you know, it's like, despite the fact the page count may have been about twice, it was really like three or four times as much material in it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Lord knows I'm guilty enough of, you know, letting books go on to try to fit everything in. Wolfpack is not a small book.
No.
It just kept being more to say in the story. Mm-hmm. It's not a uncomplicated story.
Right. I don't think any of your novels can claim to be uncomplicated. And Heir to the Dragon, I mean, the epic nature of Heir to the Dragon it kind of stands out for me, as kind of fun thing. And just kind of reading it and kind of realizing the ride that you're going on as it was going. I remember, you know, kind of rereading it earlier this year. I was like, whoa, all right, we're in a totally different time era. All right, let's do it. What's happening here? It was a fun one.
Well, that was a challenge. You know, they wanted the Ted Kurita story.
Yeah.
You know, they basically wanted a biography of the guy as a novel.
Right.
And that means you've got to cover a lifetime.
Yeah. Well, and it's impressive too, because it was such a different structure than Wolves on the Border was, and making it that kind of that epic, that odyssey, if you were kind of Teddy Kurita, but it was fun.
Well, you know, I was learning the trade to write novels. So I was
certain amount of experimentation going on.
Yeah.
You know, Woz was the first one, very conventional. And it's relatively compact in time. But Heir to the Dragon had to be much broader in time frame in order to tell a complete story and, you know, reach a conclusion where, you know, the protagonist could come out on top, but not necessarily conclude everything for, you know, the House of Caryta and the Draconis Combine.
Yeah.
Wolfpack, I experimented in another way, in that it's basically being told as a reminisce. And some of the chapters are told in the first person. And the ones where that character isn't present, they're told in the third person. Which is an exercise in learning how to write and pay attention to voice and what characters should be able to know. You know, it's something that writers have to learn if they want to be considered good writers by most people.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, every once in a while you make mistakes. Michael asked me to you know, critique his stuff. I said, you sure you want me to do that? You know, so he got what he asked for.
Yeah.
I did my best because, you know, he's just as self-taught as I am on in terms of writing.
Yeah.
And the thing he didn't share that I told him over the course of his multi-book series is that he got better. Got better at doing what he was trying to do. And that's important.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes it only comes from practice. But one of the things he missed was his characters would know things that they couldn't know, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, there's...
They can't see their own expressions, for example.
Hmm.
Right? And a lot of beginning writers miss that kind of thing, right? They shift out of a character viewpoint into an omniscient narrator and don't even know they're doing it because they don't know what those terms are.
Yeah.
When I got started, I gobbled down a lot of Writer's Digest how to be a writer books. To understand some of the mechanics of writing, not just running on what dribbles out of your head at any moment.
Michael's fortunate. You know, one of my favorite quotes is that I think it's Ben Franklin, that, you know, our critics are our friends. You know, they show us our faults. You know, and so Michael's had a great great friend in you to kind of help him through that process. You know, not too many people have Mr. Robert Charette, you know, guiding him through their fan fiction writing. But and certainly his, like, as he had kind of talked, you know, as he found that. You know, the source book writing is, you know, where his skills lay, maybe not the narrative, and the source books are wonderful. I've had a ton of fun reading those. But do you have a favorite character that you enjoy writing for, or a character you enjoy writing?
Several.
Yeah.
I enjoyed writing Jamie and Minobu. Mm-hmm. Once I got a handle on it, I enjoyed writing theater. I really liked writing Takashi and I'm going to get the name wrong. The security head.
Sabhash.
I enjoyed writing him. Again, another, you know, current world national who was Japanese, even though that wasn't his ethnic origin.
Yeah.
You know, and favorite Shadowrun characters as well. But, you know, to a large degree, the one you're living with had damn well better be your favorite.
Yeah.
because you're going to spend a lot of time with them.
Definitely.
But, you know, you can play games with this stuff, you know. it was fun, you know, rewriting Mike Stackpole's scenes from the other side.
Yeah.
But I had to be scrupulous and keep the dialogue exactly the same. When I was writing Shadowrun books, I had introduced another writer to Fossa. I recommended them that he write for them because they were looking for people who could write decent stuff. And we both wrote scenes where we used one of the other guy's characters. And for those scenes, you know, for example, in my book, I wrote the scene and told him what information needed to come out. And he wrote all the dialogue for his character.
Oh, okay. And I like that.
Reciprocity, mm-hmm. He wrote the scene with one of my characters. I wrote all the dialogue.
Yeah. Awesome. Did you write it sequentially? Like, did it was like his line, your line, his line, your line? Or
no,
was that too complicated?
Not quite that tight.
Yeah, okay.
It was probably a little back and forth about whether, you know, it, you know, doesn't have the right tone. But,
right. You
know, we each knew our character better than the other character. Mm-hmm. And they were important characters for us.
Yeah.
At the time. I mean, I was writing for Dodger, the elf Decker, who spoke in pseudo for Sooth as part of his public persona. And he was writing for his fixer, who may or may not have been a werewolf, and was heavily inspired by the other Blade Runner from Blade Runner.
Okay.
The one who left behind the origami.
Yeah, Edward James Olmos's character.
Yeah, when he was young.
Yeah. Okay. Awesome.
Yeah.
And I will, I'll do what I can to get someone over at Catalyst to reach out to you and ask you to write. If asking is the factor, then maybe, you know, they can put out a request.
No guarantees, you know.
That's all right. That's life. No guarantees in life. But if the mood strikes, the fan base would love to hear, you know, more of your stories for sure.
Yeah. You know, I've had a number of varied careers in a number of various areas. So, you know, I mean, the Shadowrun fandom, I think, feels much the same way as you and Michael do about the Battletech stuff. You know, would be happy to have me write more there. And, you know, I've got people who want me to sculpt more.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Michael even tried to find some way to convince me to sculpt another mech.
Ooh.
But
well, I'm you know, my career base is in nonprofit, as a nonprofit executive, so you know, I had to learn very early on that if you don't ask, the answer will always be no, and if you do ask, the answer might be yes. So you gotta ask. So I'll ask you and be gracious if you say no.
Well, you know, always, you know, these guys are trying to run their business too, and yeah. They've got people coming to them asking to do stuff.
Yeah.
Right. And what's in front of you is always easier to deal with than what is out of sight.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. Well, maybe we can sell them on the fact that, you know, if they put Robert Shred's name on some fiction, it'll sell a little bit better than maybe some, you know, some spring chicken out there coming that wants to write. But we'll see.
Awesome. I have a totally inconsequential question for you.
Please.
Is that a Warhammer I see on your desk?
Yeah, that's one of those old Macross ones. Yeah, the 6-inch ones. Here, I'll go grab it.
Is it a plastic model or one of the?
Yeah, it's a plastic.
But there, you're back on ears.
Oh, yeah, kind of the macro size.
But oh, okay.
Almost one of the size of my head.
Jointed ones, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, and then I got another kind of little plastic one that's about probably around the original size of what you were sculpting.
But
yeah, those are both, neither of those are Battletech products, but we won't tell anybody.
Right. Well, you know, I also did the Warhammer for Dark Horse's Robotech line.
Okay.
Which were larger sized ones.
Mm-hmm.
And was able to make all of the
the Destroids pivot at the waist because the pieces were big enough to do it.
Yeah.
And they allowed me to make multiple piece ones.
Yeah. Well, let me show off one for you. You'll enjoy then. So this was the first miniature I ever finished painting. Let's see if I can get a good view there.
And that's supposed to be Natasha's?
That's Natasha's, which is great for a beginner because it's just black with a bunch of red lines, and it looks cool. But yeah. Got the decals on there as well. So the only skill I needed was I needed to make a really, really straight line.
That's a serious skill.
It was. It took some time, but it's still one of my favorites, and it's simple. It's a black primer with some white stripes on it. But I did get the little the widow symbol kind of on that torso. I thought it looks pretty good there.
Great. It's a little hard to make out in the size resolution I've got here.
No.
But I saw the big one on the desk, and I had acquired a set that was the jointed part was sort of an inner structure, and it had the different outer armor parts, so you could build it either as a Warhammer or a rifleman or a longbow.
Yeah, yeah. Man, we didn't even talk about the Omnimex and kind of creating the Omnimex in the introduction.
Yeah,
Maybe we can, you know what?
Yeah, Michael keeps insisting on calling those things prototypes. They're just kit bashes that I used, you know. And, they weren't intended to. Ralph Parther wasn't allowed to make the Omnimex. They got somebody else to do the Omnimex who could work off the computer files.
Interesting.
Because the Omnimex came from the Battletech pods.
Right. Yeah, that was an interesting story about how the design. I think I read it in Michael's Unseen document where he was talking about how they were developed and how they had to be modular because of they had to basically have the same basic files and they just had to kind of plug and play. That was a really cool story.
I kind of watched the Kickstarter that they ran for the new plastic ones.
Yeah,
and I mean that's going to be the look of BattleTech in the future.
Yeah,
for sure. But I was kind of surprised to get exposed to the whole urban mech thing.
No.
No, they made a plush urban mech.
Yeah.
And, that was, I sculpted the urban mech for Ralph Parther originally. And, aside from the lunacy that AC-20 is one of the smallest bore cannon in the designs. It just, wow. Everyone used to hate that thing in the game back in the day.
people love their memes. It's become the meme. And I think the nuke outfitted urban mech certainly had an effect on kind of the love for it. But what are your thoughts on the plastic mechs? Do you like that kind of evolution of the miniatures, or do you, do you wish it stayed in the metal realm?
The mechs have always been all over the map design-wise. Some good ones, some not so good ones.
Yeah.
And some of that, of course, is always going to be personal taste.
Right.
And so on the whole, that hasn't changed. there are some good ones, there are some bad ones. Some of the redesigns actually, I think, are better than the original.
Yeah.
Look overall, they look a little more like they're from the same culture now.
Okay. I can see that between Innosphere and Clan. There's some redesigns that I enjoy, but I like those kind of smooth, sexier lines of the originals. It's a lot more blocky now.
Yeah, I never liked the really blocky stuff.
Yeah, so some of them.
But they've also done some really weird proportion things over the years.
Yeah,
and I never liked those either.
Yeah. I do appreciate that because it's all digital now. It's they can truly scale it, so it's perfectly scaled. So a 20-ton mech,
whatever that means.
Yeah, well,
I mean, Lord, we went around about that too.
Yeah,
it's like okay, fine. One of the reasons the first vehicles were so big was working with the concept that the mechs were supposed to be the pinnacle of technology. So if you're running the same stuff
in a tank, it's mm-hmm. going to be bigger and clunkier.
Yeah. Yeah.
Plus multiple crew members, you know? It's like...
Well, it's interesting. I have a whole new perspective on the miniatures now that I started painting them, because you look at a miniature very different when you have to put paint on the miniature. Uh-huh. And so.
Back in the day, I always used to say that sculptors should be required to paint their own miniatures.
Yeah.
So they know what they're handing people.
That is true. I like that. And that one thing I do like about the plastic ones is that it's very easy to magnetize them. And it's very easy to paint a magnetized mech, because I can just pop off the arms, paint under the arm, and go.
Yeah, they're more durable too, yeah. For sure. Yeah. About what you're going to do. They'll go the way they will. The digital sculpting has changed everything.
Yeah.
You know, back in the day, it would have been great. I mean, that's part of why some of my greens are no longer intact, because they had to be cannibalized to make another model.
Right.
Interesting. So unsurprisingly, when I finally got to do the Warhammer remake, right, then I had to do the Rifleman, right, so we could match them up mm-hmm. and be the same. And then eventually I got to do the Longbow. And since that was the last one in line, that's the one that's most intact.
Okay.
The, the same legs went through all three of them.
Yeah.
Because that's how the pieces ended up surviving.
Yeah.
I can no longer remember why it would have worked out that way mm-hmm. because normally I would do one all the way through and then do the other all the way through, but somehow not.
Yeah. Well, you got to figure out your way to get through, especially if the process is destroying kind of what you're creating on the way there. But
it was always a possibility with the, mm-hmm. That high pressure vulcanization thing would often break things mm-hmm. During the process. And, you just always with your fingers crossed to hope that the cavity survived so that they could cast masters into it.
Yeah.
And usually that was the case. But then there would be, things that would need to be repaired over time, because far and away, Battletech kept Ral Partha alive for years mm-hmm. Because of the sales. Would you care to hazard a guess to what the best-selling ever BattleTech line item that Ral Partha produced was?
Ooh. Mm. Based on what I know of how they sell now, I would almost want to say the Locust, but just because people would go crazy over buying that currently. But as far as the most popular...
All right, this is something of a trick question.
Okay, okay.
The Hex Base.
Okay.
I mean, think about it. I mean, once you know, it makes perfect sense.
Yeah, yeah.
No matter what the mech is, you need a Hex Base.
Yeah, yeah. That's too funny. That's a moneymaker, huh? That's the bottom line. Uh-huh. The bottom line is the Hex Bases. That's too funny.
They cast more of those things than any mech.
Well, I gotta imagine.
For obvious reasons.
That's hilarious.
But in terms of the, back in the day anyway, mm-hmm. I mean, there may have been things that changed it, but the Warhammer and the Marauder were far and away the most popular.
Popular mechs. Yeah, there's definitely command the highest kind of prices on the secondary market these days. The Warhammer is my favorite, in terms of the look. And I actually only have one Marauder, and I haven't pulled it out of the blister yet, because I want to save it for a professional painter to deal with.
Is it the original Marauder or mine?
It's yours. It's the Ral Partha. I got mine in the blue blister, the lead free ones.
That will stay together a little bit better than the original.
Excellent.
And you won't lose the autocannon on top quite as easily.
Yeah. Those two, what I was saying is like in the new plastics, people, the locusts are really hard to find, because everybody wants to do their locust swarms.
I was always fond of locusts myself.
Yeah. It's a good looking mech. What was it? Crusher Joe, I think.
Crusher Joe.
Awesome.
That's one where I actually liked the BattleTech redesign over the Japanese one.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I the BattleTech. I like the Like the Archer, I like the Archer and the original designs, the Macross designs, but you know, all the other ones I like the updates, the tweaks that BattleTech did. But and I'm glad it's nice to live in an age now where those can be produced again. So I kind of I was going through college and starting a career in the years where they couldn't be used. So I came back at the right time.
Yes. I didn't even know about the whole Unseen thing till Michael got in touch with me.
Wow.
I mean, I knew there were issues with Harmony Gold, but
yeah. Well, you escaped the headaches then. You got lucky.
But the whole thing was just a fuster cluck.
Yeah, that's a odd sense of entitlement by Harmony Gold, you know, looking back on it.
Well, things happen. I mean, you know, sort of perhaps in karma for us, or, you know, got their own stuff ripped off at one point.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, they were talking with a toy company about doing an official BattleTech line.
Mm-hmm.
The toy company, you know, went through the process, you know, looked at their stuff, you know, and then said, no thanks, and then put out a line.
Yeah, that was the Mad Cat, right? The Mad Cat Timberwolf toy, if I recall.
Could be.
But could be.
Cool. I didn't follow it that much.
Yeah.
Cool. But, you know, those kind of things happen. Big corporations do that all too often.
Yeah. Well, it's
happens even to bigger things than game companies.
Definitely. Well, it's that's when you grow up, you understand the legal system and justice a little bit more. Is that
But it ain't always justice.
It's not about right
to get away with.
Oh yeah, that's why it's not about right and wrong. It's about who has the most money to invest in attorneys.
Who's got the best lawyers?
Yep.
Or threat of them.
Yep. Definitely. And
the very name of BattleTech, right?
Yeah.
No, it was Battle Droids.
Yeah.
Until Lucasfilm got involved.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, thanks again, Robert. And I'll circle back and I'll let you know when this goes up.
Yes, sir. I appreciate that. And I hope this is useful for you.
Definitely.
Okay, man. Right.
Take care, Bob.
You good?
Bye. Yep.
Shoot some X.
Yep. Always.